Welcome to the Navigator newsletter podcast for the month April 2016. Or if you follow the Kemetic calendar, the year is 6250. This podcast is narrated by Ifeomi Grant and is brought to you in three parts.
Greetings. Welcome to part two of the newsletter. I've just made an assessment. This is going to be a three-parter, so apologies for that, but we'll break it up so it's not too long each part. So in part one, I was talking to you about the mass incarceration which occurred under President Bill Clinton, and I'm going to start by reading an excerpt from a Guardian newspaper article, which was entitled, "Bill Clinton, Mass Incarceration on My Watch Put Too Many People in Prison." And the article says, during Clinton's 8 years in the White House, the incarceration figures saw some of their steepest rises in modern times. Though the numbers had already begun to shoot up under Ronald Reagan's vaunted war on drugs in the 1980s, Clinton further inflated them. So, when he won his first presidential election in 1992, there were 847,000 people in prison. By the time he ended his second term in 2000, that population had grown to 1,334,000. Now, I just insert there that they're talking about the state and federal prison population, which doesn't include what they call the jail population as well. When you add the two together, you get to the current humongous figure of around 2.5 million currently incarcerated in the United States. So go back to the article. It says, vowing to be tough on crime, a quality that had previously been more closely associated with the Republicans and which Clinton adopted under his so-called triangulation ploy, he created incentives to individual states to build more prisons, to put more people behind bars, and to keep them there for longer. He also presided over the introduction of a federal three strikes law that brought in long sentences for habitual offenders. So that's our lovely Bill Clinton. And it goes on to say, well, that's from The Guardian, 2015, and the context for this, you may think, why is Clinton suddenly expressing regret? Well, of course, his wife, Hillary Clinton, was back on the campaign trail. She'd obviously been defeated by Barack Obama, and she wants her turn, continuing the sort of Bush-Clinton dynasty that was interrupted by Obama. So she wants to get into the White House. And Slick Willie, as Bill Clinton was known during his time in Arkansas and as president, he's been working hard to shore up the Negro vote as Hillary Clinton runs off against Bernie Sanders. So that's why he made his so-called apology of sorts for his role in the exponential growth in the US prison population. And I'm just going to read briefly from another excerpt from a what I consider a ridiculous article trying to paint Clinton as a moral politician who agonizes over his mistakes, as opposed to the calculated sociopathoid individual he and his wife as well are. So the article says, in a speech to the NAACP, National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, name says it all, National Convention, Clinton very prominently echoed earlier statements of regret about contributing to indiscriminate mass incarceration with his signature crime bill, the 1994 Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act. I signed a bill that made the problem worse, and I want to admit it, Clinton said. He did not disavow everything in the law, but increased incarceration was a central feature of it, and the fact that he admitted it made things worse was rightly seen as a major reversal. So in terms of what actually happened has happened under other presidents in terms of incarceration, you always need to look at the incarceration rate per 100,000 population and not just the total incarceration rate, because obviously the US population has grown significantly over time, and so you can't just look at gross figures for incarceration, because as the population gets bigger, even if the incarceration rate stays the same, the number of people incarcerated, gross figure would grow. So I've found some figures which date back to 1925 and go up to just after 2010. And what they show is that if we take the male incarceration figure, and because the vast majority of people incarcerated in the United States are men. If we take that first, it's about 1925, the incarceration figure is about 150 people per 100,000 population. Now, this steadily rises and then increases sharply during the Second European World War, actually. Leading up to the Second European World War, during the end of the Great Depression, because obviously the Great Depression had two sort of phases to it, and finally was brought to an end by the United States joining that war, which happened in 1941, but the sort of depression kind of started to come to an end around 1939 sort of time. And if we look at that, we see that it peaks, the incarceration figure peaks at around 280 people per 100,000 population in around 1939, 1940, somewhere around there. And then it falls again as America, you know, enters the war during the war period. And then it flatlines from about 1945. So 1939 to 1945, we see a significant fall in the incarceration rate. And then it pretty much stays flat until the early 1970s. So it's flat for probably about 30 years. And then it starts to increase again through the 1970s. And when it gets to 1980, Ronald Reagan, we're back to around 280 people per 100,000 population. So in 1980, we're at the same level as we are in 1939, at about 280 people. We then see under Reagan just an astronomical increase in the incarceration rate, which goes from about 280 people per 100,000 population, and it continues to climb. And the same thing happens under Reagan's successor, George Herbert Walker Bush, W's father. And so when George H.W. Bush leaves office in 1992, after being defeated by Clinton, the figures reached around 680 people per 100,000 population for men. And then under Clinton, it goes from 680 and it gets up to around 900 people per 100,000 population by the time we get to the year 2000. So that's getting close to 1% of the male population being imprisoned when Clinton left office. And it's pretty much hasn't increased very much. It did increase a bit, but nothing like the same sort of rate of increase under George W. Bush. Sort of peaked in around 2007, near the end of his presidency, and it's fallen under Obama. So we'll have to give him a little bit of credit for that. So I don't praise him for many things, but he's arrested the rise in the prison population, although it's now around nearly 2.5 million people, about 2.4 million people for the total incarceration figure. And just to put that into context, if you go back to around 1920, there were around less than 200,000 people in prison in the United States. Obviously, the population was a lot smaller. So if we even go back to when Reagan came into power, there were around maybe just under 600,000 people in prison and jail in the United States in 1980. And now it's around 2.4 million. So with all that context about what Clinton did around mass incarceration, you'd probably be surprised to learn, if you didn't already know so, that he was lauded as, quote unquote, our first black president by author Toni Morrison. I mean, she should be ashamed of having made such a ridiculous, stupid and pathetic comment. But it just shows you the state of some Africans in the United States. Now, Clinton knew how to play up to this constituency. He played a saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show. He provided lots of other empty metaphorical pats on the head for his deferential black voting bloc. Such gestures included inviting Negro ministers into the White House to provide so-called spiritual guidance, particularly when he was caught with his pants down, literally and metaphorically, pun intended, during the Monica Lewinsky affair. Jesse Jackson was one of those ministers, of course, and we know he's had his run-ins in terms of adultery scandals. And I was going to say that perhaps he and Bill Clinton were comparing notes. However, I think Jesse Jackson is an amateur in comparison to Bill Clinton. And Clinton has a much, much seedier, much more dangerous side to his character. And if you were to type in Bill Clinton rape into YouTube, you're in for a shock, because what you're going to find out is that he wasn't just a huge womanizer, which is well known. Even, I think, even the staunchest Democrat supporting person realizes that Clinton was a incredible adulterer. But it's not that. He's actually been accused of rape and or sexual assault by at least 26 different women. And you may wonder, why is it that you haven't heard much about this? And why is Bill Cosby being hauled over the coals for his allegations of rape and sexual assault? And we don't hear anything about Bill Clinton, who was a two-term president. And again, you can go on YouTube and you can see lots of information about the women who've made the allegations. And you can see that a lot of them seem very credible. And you can also see what the Clintons, both Hillary and Bill, not just Bill, Hillary and Bill, did to intimidate and threaten women who made these allegations. And there's a huge number of scandals surrounding the Clintons, not just Bill, but also including Hillary. But in terms of Bill, there's the what they call the MENA cover-up, so M-E-N-A. And again, there's a link in the newsletter to that, a YouTube video, where you can find out about Bill Clinton's role in covering up the smuggling of cocaine into the United States via Arkansas when he was governor. Now, this smuggling was being organized by the Reagan administration. You may remember Oliver North, who's one of the few people who's prosecuted as part of the Iran-Contra scandal. And what it basically involved was that the United States was importing cocaine, selling it, particularly in African communities, and using that money as a slush fund to finance the Contras, who were a terrorist group who were fighting against the Sandinista government in Nicaragua. The Sandinista government were basically so-called left-wing government. The Reagan administration didn't like them, and so they wanted to overthrow them using the Contras. And so they were funding the Contras through drugs money. And this is all during the time when Reagan was waging the so-called war on drugs, which was a war against African people. So to give Bill Clinton some credit, and there's not much I can give him, but the credit he does deserve is that he did manage to balance the US budget, and he delivered a budgetary surplus, which was thanks largely to large cuts in military expenditure following the collapse of the Soviet Union. He also committed war crimes in Serbia, which I won't have time to go into here, but you can find out for yourself again. But generally, he wasn't as militarily expansionistic as his successors, Bush and Obama, and we'll move on to them in a bit. I think, though, in terms of economic policy, Clinton should really be remembered for the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act with his friend Robert Rubin, which laid the groundwork for the current-day financial crisis, which began in 2007, and it did that by removing the protective division between retail and investment banking. He should also be remembered for his Telecommunications Act, which has led to the concentration of media ownership in the US, with six corporations now controlling 90% of mainstream US media. But after his presidency, in grateful recognition, in 2002, Bill Clinton was inducted into the Arkansas African American Hall of Fame as an honorary member. And I kid you not. And my comment would be, it just goes to show you that no one can grovel better than a coon. Such scoundrels can walk under a snake's belly. And if you can bear to read about it, I've got the link in the written version of the newsletter. So that's Bill Clinton. What a nice man. Our first black president, quote unquote. Let's move on to George W. Bush. So in terms of George W. Bush, I think he can be credited for genuinely turning the US into a fully fledged democratic fascist state. Fascism involves a merger of state and corporations. And Bush not only oversaw the gutting of the US Constitution, he also gutted the government effectively and turned over as many functions as possible to large corporations, and effectively made government little more than a conduit for siphoning taxpayer dollars to corporations. And this is what you'd call crony capitalism or corporatism at its worst. Bush the Little was the archetypal puppet president. He's proof, if proof were ever needed, that the president's a figurehead representing the interests of powerful vested interests. His administration was known as the Oil and Gas Administration. Such was his penchant for assisting the traditional energy sector. Now, as a Republican, he didn't need to waste any time pretending that he liked Africans. That's what the Democrats do. But he did appoint actually a lot more African politicians and administrators to his administration than Clinton did. Quite a few in quite senior positions. I remember as Secretary of State for the Health. I think it was Sullivan who he appointed. Didn't do anything for us, but, you know, he appointed him. And Bush will mainly be remembered by honest historians for his war on terror, with all its attendant evils, which included endless vicious wars against Muslims, the full implementation of the National Security Police State under the, you know, sort of Homeland Security legislation, a massive increase in military expenditure, which created a massive budget deficit and exploding national debt. It's really interesting how so many of these sort of Republicans never worried about national debt until Obama came in, and yet it was Bush who really kicked all this off. During his time in office, he continued to allow the US's physical infrastructure to crumble. So it's been estimated that you need about $300 billion spent just to bring roads and rail, nothing else, just roads and rail up to scratch in the US. And he also saw a slight increase in the prison population. I mean, nothing, he didn't really go as hard as Clinton, or his father or Reagan, but then they've done all the hard work already. When you inherit a prison population of over 2 million people, I mean, there's not much work left to be done. One thing that Bush did and that Obama has continued has been the institutionalization of executive signing orders, which in effect give the president the power of a quasi-monarch, able effectively to ignore the wishes of Congress and the judiciary. And this was and is completely unconstitutional. And it's important to note that whilst many Africans were quick to condemn Bush at every turn, and also white Democrats did the same, when you look at President Obama, who's continued many of the same policies, particularly in relation to foreign policy, but also in terms of bailouts and the whole financialization of the economy and serving corporations, Obama's received nothing but adulation and praise from his Negro fan base, who apparently are still working through their racial self-esteem issues. So let's move on. That's a neat segue into President Barack Obama. And what can we say about Mr. Hopey Changey? Well, my listeners and readers know I'm not a great fan of him, but I'm not a great fan of any of them. I suppose I just concentrate a little bit more on him because the praise and support from amongst African people just shows how completely delusional most of our people are and how little they understand about politics. I don't need to say too much about Obama. I'd probably describe him as a political combination of George W. Bush and Bill Clinton Mark II without the rape allegations. Obama is the ultimate example of the foolhardiness of skin colour representationalism and the worship of black firsts. He offered black voters nothing. They gleefully accepted, and he's delivered fully on that promise. Obama is highly intelligent like Clinton. He's very charismatic, although probably more naturally introverted than Clinton. But in terms of foreign and security policy, he's actually much closer to George W. Bush. Like the Bush administration, the Obama government is thoroughly infiltrated by rabid neocons, many of whose first allegiance is to Israel, and many of them are actually got dual citizenship. They're insanely Russophobic, which means they don't like Russia, and they're also insanely Sinophobic, which means they don't like China. And they believe a nuclear war is winnable. I mean, they're actually sociopaths, many of them, in my opinion. And much of Obama's presidency has been like watching a dog walker taking a large, aggressive dog for a walk and desperately trying to keep the beast on the leash. I would say, in sort of summing up Obama, he's a tool of white supremacy. He serves the plutocrats who really run the United States. However, he's also a cautious and pragmatic individual by nature, and he sometimes run into trouble from neocons for not being aggressive enough in his foreign policy. Now, this despite continuing his predecessor's endless wars, despite the Ukrainian coup, which was oiled by $5 billion from the United States, despite the Syrian civil war, which the United States has been supporting the so-called freedom fighters, who are nothing more than terrorists, who they label as ISIS or Al-Qaeda and other theatres of war. But they're supporting them along with Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Qatar, and other disparate near-the-world nations. Despite Libya, despite constant threats towards Iran, despite the nurturing of ISIS by the CIA, and an endless string of despites. He says there's no Black America, whilst he articulates the language of white supremacy with talk of American exceptionalism. He's continued and expanded the use of executive signing orders, which I referred to earlier on, despite the fact he's a constitutional lawyer. And he stood idly by while African men are slaughtered by the forces of white supremacy in and out of uniform. And all he offers Negroes are renditions of Al Green's songs, which they lap up like the contemptible cowards they are. He grovels before AIPAC, which is the American-Israeli Political Action Committee. He speaks respectfully to Hispanics and gays, whereas he comes before mainly Black female church audiences to condemn Black fathers to rapturous applause. So I would say, to finish off with Obama, we are like the abused child who prefers any attention to no attention, and Obama is a proof that there's virtually nothing a Democratic president can do to cause rejection by Black voters. Okay, so that's the end of part two. And in part three, we'll go on and examine Donald Trump.